The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dave Brooks, science writer for the Nashua Telegraph and GraniteGeek.org, sitting in for Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. Genetically modified organisms came into public view in 1980 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that General Electric could register a patent on a bacteria that consumed crude oil. 2 years later, insulin was made by genetically modified bacteria. And then came the Flavor Saver tomato, genetically tweaked to delay its ripening. The floodgates were opened. Today, genes are modified in everything from laboratory mice to corn to glowing fish. But for laymen, the whole process might as well be magic. Society is being asked to make decisions about GMOs, but it's hard to judge something you don't understand. Today on The Exchange is teaming up with Science Cafe New Hampshire, which puts on monthly discussions around the state concerning scientific and technical topics. We're going to dig into the science of GMOs, and let's hear from you, too. What are your questions about how GMOs work, and what are your concerns? You can call us on The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 892-NHPR. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. So we have two guests today, and the first one is Rob McClum, a professor of plant. He is a plant geneticist at Dartmouth College whose research focuses on plant circadian rhythms. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we also have Professor Subhash Manocha, who is a professor of plant biology and genetics at UNH. He teaches courses on genetic engineering and biotechnology, and thank you for being here.
And thank you for having me here.
So before we get going, actually, I'd like to just mention the news that came out last night, related to this issue. There were some Chinese researchers who announced that they had manipulated 86 viable human embryos. Well, actually, they were judged as non-viable, but there's some question about that. And they actually did some DNA modification of human embryos. They were trying to fix a gene that was responsible for a fatal blood disorder. Of the surviving embryos, a few of them grew to 8 cells. Most of them didn't get the fix. They were riddled with unexpected problems, and so they ended the research. But the mere fact that somebody is actually doing genetic engineering on human embryos has kind of startled the world, I think. Was it a surprise to you, Professor Manocha?
It was not a surprise in a way, because the technology has always existed. It's a matter of who takes the step and how they do it, with or without permissions from regulatory agencies, if there are any or not.
Okay. So you were waiting for something like this to happen?
In a way, somewhere in the backyard or in a garage, in a big place.
All right. Well, it certainly it brings the issue to the fore, which is a good thing we're talking about it. But for talking about it, for most laymen, like me, frankly, as I said, this is kind of like magic. So I'd like to sort of step back and talk about the science of it. This is what science cafes do around the state, is kind of give people information about issues so they can make decisions about it. So let's start out with a kind of a basic question, and I'll ask you, Professor McClung. So how many genetically modified organisms are actually out there in the wild? How much of this is happening?
Out there in the wild, probably not a lot. However, in agricultural systems, there's a great deal of planting of GMOs. The vast majority in the United States, for example, of soybeans, cotton, and corn are genetically modified plants. So there's a great deal of acreage in the United States, and also internationally, mostly in the United States, but also in Brazil, Argentina, India, and Canada, and China are the largest other plantings.
And how about you, Professor Manocha?
Well, the first question I would say is, what's the definition of a GMO? If a GMO translates into genetically modified organism by whatever method, natural or human, in that case, every living thing on this earth is a GMO. But if you strict it to somebody man-made, in other words, somebody took the DNA out and so on, then I think, Rob, what he said is very clear, that very large majority of many of our crops are genetically modified, but in nature there are a few examples that one can find, but one had to search for them.
There are non-plant examples as well. Scientific research uses fruit flies and lab rats and lab mice that have been genetically modified so they can do better testing of treatments and the like. And, of course, we've all heard about the glowing fish. They put in a gene, I forget where they got it from, into zebrafish so that they actually glow under ultraviolet light just kind of for entertainment, which I think raised some hackles as the fact you would do GMO just to make things look pretty. So let's, again, step back and say, so what exactly are genes? For those of us who haven't been in a biology class for, say, 3 decades, and I wonder if Professor McClung, if you have your a freshman student come up to you and say, what is a gene anyway? What would you say to him?
That's a good question, actually. Genes are the hereditary information. They're carried in DNA. And we all, in all of our cells, have copies of all of our genes made of a long molecule called DNA that's composed of different letters. There's 4 different types of letters in this. A gene is a stretch of those letters that typically will get turned into a protein, and the protein is an enzyme or something in your body that has some sort of function. So a gene is, in my definition, and there's not really a perfect definition of this, it includes the information to make that protein as well as the information necessary to make that protein in the appropriate cell at the appropriate time.
So it's the genes themselves aren't doing stuff to us, shall we say. They are telling the chemicals, proteins, and creating them and making them, and it's the proteins that are changing us. Is that?
That's correct. The gene is simply the information necessary to make the protein, and the protein is typically the bit that acts.
Okay. Professor Minocha?
Yeah, that's right. It's like a recipe to bake a cake. You can read the recipe and follow it and bake a cake. Cell does that exactly, follow the recipe from the gene.
And does it always work? In other words, if the recipe is there, the DNA says, you know, do this protein at this point, and does it always happen that way?
Not really. It depends on the ingredients. If you have everything, the cake comes out all right. But there are steps and processes and things that a cell needs. So having a gene is not sufficient to have everything there makes it work.
Professor McClung, is that?
Well, Professor Minocha is correct there. I would add the gene has to be correct. You can have mistakes in the gene such that the information is imperfect. You lack an ingredient from your recipe or whatever. The gene has to be correct, and genes often don't work in isolation. You might need a suite of genes to work collectively to carry out some sort of process. But one of the things that we've discovered in the last 20 or 30 years that really has, I think, surprised people is how genes are conserved across organisms. You can take a plant gene and very often, the majority of the time, it'll work just fine in an animal cell and vice versa. And so there's a great deal of conservation of gene function between vastly different types of organisms.
Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, modifying a gene does not automatically modify what the protein that is produced, or does it?
If you change the information that is the gene, then you will change in some subtle way, whether or not it has a consequence, you'll change the product of that gene when that information is used. So if you to use Professor Minocha's analogy, if you change the recipe, you will change the cake. A little change you might not notice, adding a little bit too much salt, for example. Mm-hmm. But if you add way too much salt, you're going to notice it's a salty cake.
Excellent. So let's talk about how this is done, the actual mechanism that humans do to modify genes. I mean, I have, my vision is microscopic tweezers come in and pick up a molecule and drop it somewhere else. I assume that's not actually what happens. Professor Manocha, would you start us off?
Yeah, so if a gene is a sequence of DNA, as Rob said, you have to identify it. You have to typically either cut it out or make a copy of it. The easiest thing is to make a copy of it.
So, and how do you do that? You drop some chemicals into a petri dish?
You drop some chemicals in a small microfuge tube, as it is called. Micro means everything working at very, very small volume levels, which identifies the sequence that you have in there, gives it all the recipe to copy it, and you will copy it. You won't see what is being copied, but you will be able to test that you have copied it right.
So actually, talking about the same, how do you know this is working? How do you know which gene you're looking for, and how do you know it's even there, Professor McClung?
Well, we've developed techniques to amplify up large numbers of copies of the gene that allow us to visualize it. We're getting better all the time at being able to visualize smaller and smaller quantities of any particular gene. And we've got very powerful techniques now to determine the precise sequence of the letters in that particular gene, so we can read it and determine if we've made a particular change of one letter or not.
So just to visualize, and of course we radio people love visualizing. So what is exactly does it look like? I mean, you don't see, you know, little letters. When I see it in my textbooks, you got GTA and all that. But how do you know which gene is which? What does it look like?
Well, genes all are characterized by their information, by the particular letters. So really the analogy is to words in a sentence. And so gene 1 might read one set of words. Gene 2 might read another set of words. Those words might be related, or they might be quite dissimilar. And it's all in that information, the primary sequence, we call it, the sequence of those letters.
But is it like, you know, different colors on the computer screen you're looking at, and that's how you know which gene is there? Or?
Yeah, basically, when you get the initial data, we rapidly convert it into letters because it's much easier to read those letters. But they will there are a variety of ways of doing it, and color is one of them. We can read the sequence of letters in a stretch of DNA, one at a time, from one end to the other end. And one of the classic ways is to have them all tweaked a little bit so they fluoresce with a slightly different color. And then we'll see green, red, black, blue in some sort of sequence. But the green corresponds to one letter. The red corresponds to another letter.
Sort of like a disco, then.
Yeah, very much.
All right. Well, coming up on The Exchange, more about the science of GMOs. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Dave Brooks of the Nashua Telegraph and GraniteGeek.org and Science Cafe, New Hampshire. I'm in for Laura Conoy. We're digging into the science of GMOs, genetically modified organisms. You can join us with your thoughts. Call in. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477 or 892-NHPR by an astonishing coincidence. Or you can email us at exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Just for a little bit more about the actual process of how a genetic modification find happens. So, Professor Manocha, so you've got genes that you know what the sequence is, and you want to change one of them from what it is to something else.
Well, we don't really change from what it is to what it is else necessarily. You take that gene, and you have to modify its controlling elements because plants have different controlling elements. We call them promoters. So join the two and eventually get it into a cell of a plant. Once it is in the cell of a plant, then you grow the cell into a whole plant and then test it out that the plant has the gene and is the gene functioning or not.
Okay. That makes sense. So we actually gotten some emails here, and here's one that leads into a question I was going to get to in a moment, but let's do it right now. This is an email from Connie who asks, what is the difference between hybridization and genetic modification? So hybridization meaning sort of, I guess, the breeding of plants that's been done since, you know, in the plains of Africa. Professor Manocha?
Well, hybridization is a process by which you combine all the information from two different species or very related organisms and try to search for one that will give you the results that you wanted, and you eliminate what you don't want. It takes multiple generations. Over 10, 15 generations, you can improve the plant for the properties that you wanted. For genetic engineering, you take out the information from one place, put it in the other, and you have it in the first generation. So that's a big difference. The outcome may be almost the same, not exactly identical.
And Professor McClung, is that basically the way you see it as well?
Yes, and I think there's a couple of things that are important that one needs to emphasize there. When you hybridize, you're combining all the information from two different organisms. And then you go through a long process, as Professor Manosha said, to retain the property that you're interested in and shed the other properties that you're not interested in. At the end, when you're done, it's somewhat imprecise. In genetic modification, in this other type of genetic modification, you're introducing simply very precisely one little bit of DNA and one little bit of information, and you know what you've put in, and you know what you haven't put in, which is all the other stuff. And so there's, in addition to the speed, there is a precision and a control over the process that you don't have so readily in hybridization.
Okay. And how easy is it to do? Again, the layman, we tend to think you'd sort of grab a gene and you drop it in and, hey, presto, it works. But I imagine it's probably not like that, Professor McClung.
It really depends on which, in the case of plants, which plant you're trying to modify. Some plants are really easy. The lab rat of the plant world, Arabidopsis thaliana, it's a mouse ear cress, it's called. It's an inconsequential little weed with tiny little white flowers. But it's the plant that people are studying all over the world. It's very easy to manipulate the DNA of Arabidopsis. It's quite possible, but more challenging to do so with the DNA of, say, corn or rice.
Okay. Professor Manocha?
In terms of the easiness, if what we do is an example, in summer we have a high school students program. They can do it at a teaching lab at the University of New Hampshire. So my statement is, if a high schooler at the University of New Hampshire can produce genetically engineered plants, it got to be easy.
I actually know. I know there are a number of high schools around the state that do genetic modification as part of their advanced biotech classes. Today, we're talking about the science of GMOs with our two guests, Subhash Manocha of UNH and Rob McClung of Dartmouth College. You can join into the conversation by calling 1-800-892-6477, 892-NHPR, or send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. So, Since we sort of started talking about how easy it is or isn't, so let's talk about what are some of the problems with doing this. Does it – unintended consequences, I suppose, to the beginning. When you do genetic modification, genetic engineering, do you always know what's going to happen, or is it often a surprise?
It is often a surprise to the extent that you don't know where the gene is going to get stuck in the DNA of the organism. On the other hand, many of the properties are predictable because the gene that you have taken out, as Dr. McClung said, you already know its function. So the surprises are if it gets stuck at the wrong place, you have to test out and select the plant that has the properties that you are looking for.
Is it easy to know the relationship between a given property and a given gene?
In many cases, it is. As a simple example, if you want to produce insulin in plants, you know what you're looking for. You search for insulin. If you're searching for making a plant tolerant to drought, you are facing a very different issue because drought is a very complex issue and you cannot predict based on the gene whether you will get it or not.
Professor McClung, is that the way you see it as well?
Absolutely. Some processes are easy to track. I think a critical thing that Professor Manocha mentioned was when you introduce a gene into an organism's DNA, you don't always have perfect control of where it goes. However, what we can track very carefully is where it goes. And so what you do is you make multiple plants, and then you look for the one where it's gone someplace benign, where there are no alterations that you might be concerned about, where it's only producing the result that you are looking for.
So, and actually, speaking about that, I mean, when this is done, are there often other modifications that were unexpected? I mean, I assume there must be. Biological systems are so complicated. This isn't as simple as a car engine. So when you switch a gene because you want to, you know, create insulin, I don't know, and you find that it also causes the plant to turn orange or something. Does that happen very often?
It doesn't have to happen. You can control that. But if something like insulin or many genes that do not perform a function within the cell of the plant, it's quite easy to say that there are no other consequences as long as a gene is not interrupting another gene's function. On the other hand, if you modify the plant metabolism, let's say you want to produce more amino acid of a certain type, you could change the chemistry of the cell, and you have to be very careful as to which direction you go with those plants.
Professor McClung, is that what happens in your work? Is you're trying to do X and you find you're also doing Y?
By and large, no, but the things that I'm trying to do in my lab tend to be a lot more targeted, and so we have a much better sense of what we are and aren't doing. I would also point out one of the concerns right now that we have, the unintended consequence, is sort of inherent in the way we're currently introducing genes into plants and into other organisms. However, technology is being developed to allow this to occur very, very, very precisely. And this is already developed, for example, to make a transgenic mouse. You can put a piece of DNA precisely where you want. And that technology is just coming online now in the case of plants. So I think the potential for these unintended consequences due to where you put a gene, I think that potential is going to decline a lot. We're still going to retain the issue that Professor Manosha mentioned. When you start messing with metabolism, that you have to think about is this. It's not a simple linear pathway of A goes to B goes to C. Rather, it's a very complicated network, and if you perturb one place, you know, it's the butterfly wings fluttering in Mexico leading to, you know, a rainbow in Europe or something. And so there it's going to require a lot more careful monitoring of what has actually happened.
And that leads, I think, to a concern many people have about GMOs, is that it's so, or genetic modification, genetic engineering, is that it's so very powerful that if something goes wrong, it'll go very wrong. Are there concerns for health about, and specifically in food? I mean, a genetically modified food that can produce health effects in those who eat it, for example. Is that the sort of thing that that you all have, that you have concerns about, Professor Manocha?
Eventually, one would be concerned about it when you start really making major changes in the metabolism of the plants. But if you already know the gene that you are introducing, you have been exposed to it, people have been around with it, both in terms of consumption as well as in the environment, I think those concerns are not as big as they've been brought out in some conversations, but without, I would say, scientific evidence in most cases. We have been around. We've had these genetically modified crops in the United States for almost 20 years now. And as one reads, it has not caused any sickness more than what natural plants do, or actually in some cases even less.
I know. So Science Cafe in New Hampshire in Nashville, we had a session on GMOs last fall, and the Science on Tap, which is the Science Cafe that's run by Sea Science Museum in Manchester, they had a session on GMOs this spring, and a lot of the same questions came up. And one of the issues when we did our session in Nashua, we had actually a high school teacher who teaches biotech, and he talked about one of the things he does with his kids is he has them bring in pretty much any food they can find, and they test it for GMO corn. And he says it's basically in everything for all practical purposes. It even sneaks into things that are labeled as organic just because it's so very difficult to get non-GMO corn in the United States. So the argument some people make is that if there were health problems, at least from that, we'd have seen them by now. But that's a complicated argument. You talked about new technologies. So how much is this changing, the actual technology of genetic engineering? I mean, is this, you know, are we seeing a Moore's law here where it's getting twice as good every couple of years, or is the actual techniques sort of leveling out, Professor McClung?
I think at this point they're not really leveling out. I think we're still seeing a vast improvement in the ability to do this, and I think that's going to continue for some time. One of the points that, just to follow up on the point that Professor Manocha made about the how widespread genetically modified plants are in our food supply, there was a very interesting result that just was published this week, that it turns out one of the ways that we introduce genes into plants is to use a bacterium called Agrobacterium. It's a normal bacterium that lives in the soil that causes galls on plants. And we can use that bacterium. It does so by transferring DNA into the plant. And we use that bacterium in the lab to transfer DNA into plants. It turns out that there's a recent study that looked at sweet potatoes. And all cultivars of sweet potatoes that are out there that people are eating and have been eating since sweet potatoes were cultivated, all those natural cultivars, none of which have been genetically modified by people, have all been genetically modified by this bacterium, Agrobacterium. And so Agrobacterium has transferred DNA into every sweet potato that any person has ever eaten. And there are, as far as I know, not a great deal of health effects associated with the consumption of sweet potatoes.
The fact that using bacteria and are viruses also used sometimes to transfer genes into for genetic engineering, sort of as a carrying mechanism?
Not in plants typically. They are in animal cells.
Okay,
you can use viruses.
One of the concerns that laymen sometimes have is that if you're using bacteria and viruses, which sounds scary to us, to do this sort of carrying for you, aren't you afraid that some attribute of the virus or the bacteria is also going to be carried into the target plant inadvertently? Is that ever come up?
That's one of the issues that's frequently raised, and that doesn't seem to be a big problem. We have a great deal of precision in this, and we've eliminated basically all the bacterial components except for a couple of little bits on either end from the DNA that we move into a plant. And in animal systems, if you're using a virus, again, the viruses are disarmed, so they aren't capable of propagating themselves in the cells. So people have taken a great deal of effort to make sure that that's not a major problem.
Professor Manocha?
Yeah, I think the first point is that any virus or any bacterium that has been used so far has been in our environment and around our cells for millions of years, as long as animals and us have lived. So these are not the viruses that are exotic enough taken from a place where we know it could cause a problem. So a routine virus further disarmed to take away a gene that causes the disease in the plant should not have any consequence for humans because we eat those viruses as a part of our normal crops. They may be infected.
Okay. Another concern that frequently comes up is if you've modified the gene of a plant for some reason, such as to resist a disease, that might spread to a relative in the wild. I don't know if that is that what they mean by jumping genes, that term I sometimes hear, Professor Manocha?
Yes, that concern is a very valid one in certain ways because it has environmental consequences to make plants more tolerant of the particular disease or chemical that you were working on. On the other hand, one also finds many of these properties within the plants already existing over the length of evolution. So that concern one has to be worried about. That's a part of our agricultural cultivation system versus natural environments. And there are methods to reduce and prevent the spread of those genes, and many of them would be easier to incorporate into our cultivated crops.
Professor McClung?
A lot depends, I think, on the traits that you're introducing, for example, into a cultivated crop. Most of, for example, the corn or the soybean that are planted today have been genetically modified to be resistant to an herbicide. And so that confers an advantage in a field where the herbicide is applied. But if that gene were to spread to a wild plant, it's not going to give it any advantage in the nearby fields or forests, unless it'll only gain an advantage in those very agricultural fields where the people are applying that herbicide. So the importance of the jumping genes, the concerns with the jumping genes, will depend a lot on the specific biology of what that gene is doing. And conferring an advantage in an agricultural field is not conferring an advantage in a nearby non-agricultural setting.
Well, we have an email here from Barbara who actually discusses this very issue. She says that some genetic modification, such as occurs in nature, say resistance to drought or shade, seems fine. Some modification that would not occur in nature, and she gives the example, resistance to chemicals such as Roundup, they can have unintended consequences. This type of modification causes excessive use of herbicide, can create super weeds, and can encourage farmers to repeatedly plant the same crop and harm soil microbes rather than using conservation practices. This, she says, is the sort of GMO that makes no sense at all and should not be permitted. And obviously that's getting into policy, which we don't want to do just yet. I'm sure we will in the third section. But that actually does lead to a question as what kind of genetic modification is useful. Professor Manocha?
Yeah, so if one goes back to, if you are of our age group, you probably remember the Green Revolution. And if you're not, you probably find that in the history books. Green Revolution was based 100% on mutations, on changing genes by different methods. It was not a magic. It was a very rough and random process. If we are doing the same thing with precision, one can see the advantage. We never bothered about mutation as a harmful thing, although during that process we created many plants that were undesirable.
Okay. Thank you. Well, we're going to take a quick break. Coming up, more on the science of GMOs. Stay with us on NHPR. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Dave Brooks of the Nashua Telegraph and GraniteGeek.org and Science Cafe New Hampshire, sitting in for Laura Kanoi. Today we're talking about the science of GMOs, genetically modified organisms, with our two guests, Subhash Manocha of UNH and Rob McClung of Dartmouth College. You can join in the conversation by calling 1-800-892-6477 or sending an email to exchange@nhpr.org. We've gotten a couple emails of people who are a little concerned about the effects of what GMOs can do. So before I get into those, let's actually talk about some of the reasons why, the benefits. I mean, this is expensive stuff to do. It's not easy. So why the heck are we doing it? Professor Manocha.
Okay, let's take an example of the very well talked about and very prominent GMO, which is resistance to insects by a gene commonly called the BT gene, which comes from a bacterium called Bacillus thuringiensis, which has been used by the farmers for quite some time to kill insects. We used to kill insects with insecticides, using millions of pounds of insecticides to kill insects, which will kill almost every insect. When the scientists transferred one gene from this bacterium into corn, that was very specific to an insect that basically harms corn only. So what we did was we used this corn to have this gene. The plant will kill the insect if the insect eats the plant, otherwise not. But in the meantime, we saved hundreds of millions of dollars of pounds of insecticide that we did not use in our agriculture. So is there a benefit to the environment to that? In some ways, one says yes, we didn't use insecticides. Could it cause harm to the insects? Yes, the insect that eats the corn, but not necessarily to other insects unless that corn gets into their food, and that also would be very, very few species.
Professor McClung?
That's one very common example today of an advantage associated with GMOs. I think what's coming down the line are going to be other more subtle, in addition to insecticides, for example. For example, we know that we're facing increasing drought stress, particularly in the southwest U.S. So there's a great deal of effort to engineer plants that are more water efficient. And that's the sort of thing that's going to enable agriculture to persist with a lesser footprint on the environment. Another thing, the classic example that we hear of associated with nutritional improvement is golden rice. So we know that vitamin A deficiency is a huge problem, particularly in the developing world, where a great number of people derive almost all their food from rice. Rice is a very poor source of vitamin A. Or proto-vitamin A. And so Ingo Petrakis and now Willie Grissom, carrying on that work, have introduced a pathway that's normally found in rice leaves into the endosperm, the part of the seed that we eat, to allow the seed to also make pro-vitamin A. It turns the seed an orangey-golden color, hence the name golden rice. And eating this rice has been demonstrated to improve vitamin A nutrition. It's estimated right now that about 700,000 people a year, typically children, die from the consequences of vitamin A deficiency in the developing world. So if one could improve their vitamin A nutrition, we could save a lot of lives. So I think that's an example of a nutritional improvement that could have very broad and positive consequences.
Okay, well, we're going to go to a caller now. We have Dan from Peterborough. Dan, you are on the air.
Oh, thank you. I just want to point out that your guests have done a really good job of whitewashing the notion that we can genetically modify plants for resistance to herbicides and pests without affecting those that consume the products. Also, they pointed out in a very unclear way that hybridization versus genetic modification would, as I think they implied, that they would eventually get to the same point, but that it would be impossible through hybridization for plants to take on herbicide and pest resistance in the way that genetically modified plants do.
Well, that's a good point, and that's a good question. And how about it, Professor Manocha? Specifically, you would never be able to hybridize a plant to produce to handle pesticides.
Absolutely. That statement is not correct. I would say hybridization can get you where you want. It just takes long times. On the other hand, the genetic engineering provides a shortcut for many things. But if there are no properties of the type that you want in the crop that you're interested in, they cannot be imported from species that are completely unrelated. For example, you cannot hybridize a corn with a potato plant to make it resistant to something that's present only in potato and you want to transfer to corn. So the point is of stretching the imagination to the point where you can make useful plants, but at the same time, yes, hybridization has served us over tens of thousands of years, and I think we'll continue to do so unabated. That's not going to be compromised.
Okay, and now we're going to go to Sarah, who is from the Lakes region, who I think has some concerns. Sarah, are you there?
Yes, hello.
Hello.
How are you? Thanks
Good.
For taking my call. I wanted to ask, I have heard on another radio show and done some research on myself the fact that I have a concern similar to the other caller, that the genetically modifying the plants, putting in these genes of pesticides, you know, splicing them with pesticides and other things can cause birth defects with humans and also brain damage and sterility. And so I'm concerned about that.
Okay.
And also, they were saying this has been going on for 20 years, nothing has happened. Well, autism is hugely on the rise. So, and there's other illnesses too. So I don't think enough research has been done. with people or animals eating these GMOs to know.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. How about that, Professor McClung? Is it possible that there are actually problems that we haven't seen?
Well, it's very difficult to prove a negative. All the studies that have been done to date have not substantiated issues of allergies, birth defects, adverse health consequences, and certainly there's no scientific establishment of a link to autism associated with the consumption of GMOs. It's I think difficult to absolutely prove that couldn't possibly be the case, but the studies that have been conducted don't support any of these links.
Okay. Would you agree with that?
I think historic correlation.
I'm sorry. What were you saying?
That doesn't mean that more studies shouldn't be conducted, but all the studies that have been conducted so far have not supported those links.
Okay.
I agree. And the point I was making is that historic correlations between events that happen independently of each other do not automatically provide cause and effect relationships. We have space station in the space for the last 15 years now. Could that be associated with autism because autism has increased in those 15 years? I think it's very far stretched. When it comes to GMOs, a very similar kind of a correlation sometimes is brought up because of the history and timing correlations, not a cause and effect.
Okay. And now we're going to go to Arnie from Concord. Arnie?
So as I'm listening to this conversation, I keep thinking, have you studied alternatives other than altering genes? And I will give you an example. In Kenya, there is something that is being explored called push-pull, and it looks at concerns about weeds, poor soil fertility, the parasites that affect crops, and rather than trying to alter the crop, they're looking at natural things that will basically address all those potential failures that GMO foods and crops are trying to develop. So, for example, in push-pull, which has actually been developed in Kenya, they found that they could plant legumes in between the rows of the corn, and that the legume grew faster than the weed, and as a result, it didn't affect the corn, but it also kept the weeds down. And then at the end of the season, they could turn the legumes back into the soil, and it fertilized the soil.
Okay.
They were concerned about parasites that affected the corn. They found a grass that had a sticky substance on it that was attractive to the parasite that would attract the corn. They planted the grass around the corn. The parasites went to the grass, got stuck, never basically got to the corn. So all those things that you're talking about, drought and water and fertilizer and parasites and weeds, have we explored natural alternatives that produce the results we're looking for that are equally successful? And in the country of Kenya, check it out. Push-pull is being developed, and therefore GMOs are lovely, but they're lovely for big corporations because they then control the
okay.
crop.
Let's think about it. How about that, Professor McClung? Would you think that there are natural or at least non-genetically engineered alternatives to much of what is being done with GMOs right now?
Well, I think a lot of the debate about this is focused on either or, and I think that's a mistake. I think we face a huge problem globally. It's estimated we need to increase agricultural production by about 50 to 70% in the next 50 years. So that's a big task, and I think we want to deploy all the technologies we can. Clearly, there are many aspects of agronomic practice that could be improved, and push-pull is an example of that should be pursued as much as possible, but I think it can be supplemented with GMOs where GMOs are appropriate. And I think GMOs can be deployed to not simply benefit agribusiness. For example, golden rice is going to be benefiting small-holding rice farmers, so not agribusiness at all. So I really don't think it's an either-or. Another example coming out of Africa, Uganda, there's a strain of rice wheat rust that's emerging in Uganda. And all the current commercially planted wheat is susceptible to this particular strain of wheat rust. So there's a great need to develop new varieties of wheat that are resistant to this rust, and there is an imperative to do it very quickly. So classic hybridization technologies can help, but one can presumably do it faster perhaps with GMOs. And so there's really a need not to do one or the other, but rather to do both, because there is a pressing global need to increase agricultural production.
All righty. We're going to take a call now from Corky in Manchester. Corky, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm finding this extremely interesting, but I wanted to ask if you knew anything about the opal apple, I believe out of Washington State. I was in Florida this winter. It wasn't a whole food store that I went to, but it was a store that was similar, and they had these opal apples. My sister from Texas told me about the apple, and that you could serve it with cheese and crackers, and it did not turn brown.
And you think it's a genetically modified one?
Well, I'm just wondering about that. I have, ever since I've come back to New Hampshire, I've looked for this opal apple, and no one has it.
How about that, Professor?
Okay, if you search for the news of last month, you will find that the USDA has formally approved the growth of that apple that will not turn brown when you cut it. It is a genetically modified apple. It's the first genetically modified apple by this technique of genetic engineering that has been formally approved. So last month was approved. It should be on the market. It'll take a couple of years before the plants are mature enough to get it, but it should be available very soon.
So that would not be the opal apple she saw.
I don't know what the name of it would be, but this is the apple that will not turn brown when exposed to open air because it has a gene that has been altered that makes it brown by phenolic reactions.
It's trademarked as the Arctic apple, and it was developed in British Columbia.
Excellent. Well, I don't know. I kind of like brown apples, but anyway. So we have an email here from Claire that I think summarizes a lot of people's concerns. And she says, I'm a believer in science, but I'm also a believer in human knowledge limitations. How long did it take for scientists to make a link between cigarette smoking and lung cancer? How long did it take scientists to discover that DDT was decimating raptor populations? We must remember we don't know everything. We can't foresee the unintended consequences, and so must err on the side of caution. And I refuse to believe that GMOs are safe yet, she says. And I think that's a very common attitude, is that these are so very powerful that we have to be extra, extra cautious with this, with them. And what do you say to that, Professor?
My answer would be absolutely what we have found with time is if we keep an eye on it, if we keep on performing experiments and do science on looking for its consequences, whether they're environmental or they are health-related, or sometimes they are ethical and moral issues as well. If we are aware of them and we talk about them in our schools and colleges and everywhere else, I think we'll be able to help regulate these problems. There is no way to look at an unintended consequence that might take 100 years, but there are ways to calculate unintended consequences based on some risk-benefit analysis that one can, through regulation and improvement of our technologies, we can deal with. There's nothing in the world that has no unintended consequences. The wheel, if it was not invented, we would not have any wars, we would not have ever killed anybody. The wheel has caused a lot of problems which are unintended. It was not invented to kill people, but now we transport our weapons with it and kill people. So it's a way of looking at it.
Professor McClung, what would you say to somebody like that who said that they're so powerful that we should be super cautious?
Well, I agree that caution is warranted. We live in a world that's characterized by cost-benefit analysis. So I mentioned earlier that there's a compelling need to increase agricultural productivity, and this offers a way to do so very effectively. Most other aspects of technology have costs and benefits. So I drove to work today using an internal combustion engine. That's a benefit, but we know there's a cost. It's the anniversary of the huge oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. There's a cost to extracting oil from the ground. It doesn't probably mean that we need to immediately cease the extraction of oil from the ground. And so in the same case here, we face pressing human needs, and we have to balance those pressing human needs against the potential for some risk.
Excellent. So All righty. Well, that's about it. We're running out of time. We've been talking about the science of GMOs with two guests, Subhash Manocha of UNH and Rob McClone of Dartmouth. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And I'm Dave Brooks with the Nashua Telegraph and GraniteGeek.org and Science Cafe New Hampshire. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Producers are Faith Meixel and Jason Moon. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm sitting in for Laura Kanoi. Thank you.